This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for January 5th, 2021. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels, and I'm very glad you're here. So, before we get to the guests we have to look forward to in 2021, we're going to take a quick moment to look back at some of our favorite moments from 2020. It's a good old-fashioned clip show. This is a bonus episode, which means Patreonizers won't be charged for it, and that you won't have to wait 2 weeks for another one. You'll get another one next week. So, without further ado, let's get right into some of the cool conversations we have had over the course of a relatively uncool year. Let's actually go ahead and begin at the end of the year with Zach Barth talking about Mobius Front 83 and the military manuals that inspired it. Is it fair to say the game is almost like what would war be like if it were what is described in these manuals as opposed to what it actually is, like to some degree?
I mean, that's kind of an abstract, like what would war be like if it was nothing like war? Like,
that's what the people who are interested in like the rules of engagement are really asking at the end of the day, right? Like, what would war be like if it were nothing like war? How can we make war less like war?
Right? Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a hot take, right? Saying that a lot of people who are into this stuff actually have no idea what they're talking about and are actually like talking about some sort of abstracted fantasy version of it. Yeah, right? I believe that. I think we did it a little bit more like transparently. It's like, no, this game is really about these manuals. I really have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, you make another. This isn't a spoiler. It's just an allusion. But like, it makes a repeated Zachtronics move, and like, you signal that by things getting weird in a couple of different ways in a couple of different places, right? Like, no. This isn't supposed to be real life. We're doing something a little different here to make a point about stuff.
Exactly.
What first principles did you come away from? One of the things, like, because you included some of your source materials with the game, and one of the things that I think, you know, makes the 80s especially interesting, you know, with anti-tank weapons and anything, or as the manual puts it, you know, the modern military hardware is like the ancient Oriental game of rock, paper, scissors. And I think that's, to a certain degree, what the game is about. My friend Ian and I were kind of exchanging notes, and he said that, like, that, you know, it's a game about how tanks aren't what they mean in the vernacular, right? Like, built like a tank or whatever. The tanks are actually squishy. So yes. Like, what is the place of a tank in that, like, what, like, Fire Emblem weapons triangle or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's one of the funny things that somebody observed on Twitter, is that's like, okay, they've literally included a weapons triangle, like, in the manual, right?
Right.
And
right. I was going to say, like, I think that of that is the single goofiest thing in Fire Emblem, the weapons triangle. But then here it is, dead seriously, in a real manual about fighting real wars.
And I don't even think it's a specific, and obviously everything I say, I have no idea what I'm talking about. I want to be crystal clear about that with you and everybody who's listening. I don't know any of this from experience. And even if I did from experience, it would be so narrow that it wouldn't generalize to everything. So I don't want to come across you like, oh, well, I've read a bunch of books about the military, because that's like the worst, right? One of the biggest existential risks to me as like a human being going into this project is coming away thinking like I've learned anything, you know, because that's dangerous, right?
Yeah, but, no, well, that's why this podcast is not the Joe Rogan Experience. Exactly. And that's why Zachtronics games gesture at not being that in so many ways.
Exactly. But with that out of the way, I learned a lot. And one of the things I think to answer your question is that, like, the ancient Oriental game of rock, paper, scissors, which is the funniest line from that book. Those kinds of relationships are not limited to the 80s. I think it's really like whenever you have things that are like adversarial to each other, it makes a lot of sense to like come up with ways to counter a specific thing. And then you end up with these complex webs of things countering other things.
Mm.
And so I think that's just like a thing that's universally true about like adversarial systems where people like, I don't know how to generalize this. I don't know what like the calculus is where this is like merely one like solution of like this whole possible system, but like when you have like, you can't just stack everything in one place at a time, so there's like a spatial component, and then things can be designed that are better at countering specific other things. Like, this is how you sort of end up with the space of things that includes war games, right? I'm gonna jump to something totally different for a second, but like one of the big things that came up that like I sort of felt was lurking at the bottom of all these things we were reading is that like war is kind of like it's like based on the idea that people take up space, right?
Sure.
And that, like, if I'm in a space, you're not in that space because we can't exist in the same space. And I feel like I think, well, this is getting jumping to another point, I guess. But like one of the for every project we do, it's a learning experience for me, and this is no exception. And I think one of the things that sort of hit me the hardest of spending, I've been working on this game for years. Like, I started working on this game 3 fucking years ago, right? And like started doing research. And like one of the things that's really like become clear to me after doing all this research is that, like, oh, like this is one of like the things that's absolutely like a tyranny of existence, is the idea that we have to physically exist in space. And that, like, sure. If I exist somewhere else, like somebody else can't exist there. And like space is limited sometimes, right? And like that causes like a sort of conflict where it's like, well, we both can't physically exist in the space at the same time. Like, one of us has to die, you know?
Like, well, sure. If you really, really abstract most conflict, like you know, that escalates the level of war in human history.
Yeah.
You know, whatever ideology gets ascribed to it or not, like, that's what it's about. Like, you know, you could say competition for resources, but at an even more basic level, just competition for a place that is desirable for one reason or another. Like you say, exactly. Space. Yeah,
exactly. And yeah, oftentimes space includes stuff like resources that come out of that space, like the fact that there's like carrying capacity for land if you don't have like artificial fertilizer or whatever. Anyway, but like, so this like tyranny of space is like one of these like core axioms of like the thinking that went into this game. And so on top of that, like if you can't like stack all your weapons in one location safely or whatever, you need to spread them out. But then you want to have stuff that cancels out, like counters out other stuff specifically. And so that means that you have to have specializations that, again, can't all be packed into the same space. And so you end up with this kind of rock, paper, scissors like relationship where, like, you know, we have tanks, which are good against infantry, but then we know that tanks are a threat, and we have like modern computer control technology, so we build missiles that can blow up those tanks, like the ATGMs, the anti-tank guided missiles you were alluding to. And so that enters into the equation. And so these kind of relationships always exist.
Next, let's take a turn away from core mechanics and talk a bit about difficulty, a big theme from this year, I think. This is a conversation from way back in January, a simpler time to be sure, with David Galindo, who made Cook Serve Delicious 1, 2, and most recently, 3.
Honestly, the second game started off with me being very proud that it was extremely unforgiving. I love that. Mm. And I would market it that way. I think it was, what was it, Time to Dine? Except is how I would put some
prepare
of the promotion stuff. And that was fun, but I would get people that would tell me, you know, I love your game, but I can't play it. I have accessibility issues. And at that point, I don't think I was ready to hear that at the launch of the game, because my initial reaction would have been, well, this game isn't for you. I'm sorry. I'm not going to compromise, you know, my difficulty, my game. You know, hearing me even saying that is so stupid. But you get in this headspace. And when I had the bad launch reviews at the beginning of Cook Serve Delicious 2, I was listening to everybody. I'm like, I'll throw in whatever you want. Let's get that review score up. And I put in that Zen mode, which relaxed the game a little bit. It was way more forgiving, and people really loved it. And I was getting so many thank yous from people that could finally, you know, play the game. And that opened up my eyes in a big way. And from then on, I've always wanted to put, and in this game has like a chill mode. And you can still fail at it, but it makes it significantly easier. You can get up to a silver, you can't get a gold, but you can progress through the entire game using that mode. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, you can have that and never touch it if you don't want to, and still have this hard, ridiculously hard game if you want, and get rewarded for it if you go that way. But it was also important to make sure that people weren't missing out if they wanted to relax it a little bit. I don't want to say easier, because it's still, at its core, it's always going to be a difficult game. But relaxing it in that way, it opens up the game to a bigger audience, and that's always a good thing.
Definitely. Yeah, chill is exactly the word, right? Because the default mode, the true Cook Serve Delicious experience that hardcore fans like me crave, has no chill fundamentally, right? Like,
oh,
that's
sure.
That's sort of the point. You're always juggling too many things and having to pay attention and interpret information really quickly. That's sort of the pleasure of the game. But it's both alienating for a certain audience, and as you say, not especially capital A accessible, to insist that the game has to be played that way. So I'm all for when you can find a solution where, for people who want that, it takes nothing away from that hardcore Cook Serve Delicious experience for there to be an alternative, which other people either have to do for because of disability or whatever, or simply would prefer because they're not quite as ready to climb the mountain, so to speak.
And we will have a bigger audience coming into this game simply because, you know, we have these two voice actresses that are, well, they're Twitch streamers and they have a big community. And I know a lot of them have never played this game. And for a newcomer, it is a hard game. But, you know, I with these modes, hopefully, if they want to just experience the story and they want to just hear Nega Oryx or Havana and the storyline, they can easily do that. You know, we've come a long way from the Halo difficulty tiers of like, this is the game, this is the way the game is meant to be played. You're like, ugh, just shut up. Like, why even have difficulty if you're going to do that? Like, you're already chastising players to choose anything but that. And I'm glad we're moving away from that.
Speaking of it being inherently good when more people can play your game, we also spoke with Greg Haynes of Able Gamers this year, and he did talk a fair bit about difficulty and, more broadly, challenge. But that was a good third of the interview and therefore did not make a good clip. Instead, let's hear him talk about something more sort of basic and pragmatic, which is how big an addressable market disabled folks are and how we can use that fact to get companies to act right.
What the goal of the research we do is to educate the community at large about there being a viable market in the gaming space, to appeal to that capitalist mindset. Because, you know, I'll be honest, we know that I know it's the right thing for people to be able to play a game. I know it's the right thing that accessibility be prioritized and that be a focus. I know that's right. But often we see, and I'm not saying that these businesses don't care about people with disabilities. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is we know that businesses have to operate from a financial perspective. And I think that generally speaking, there was a dearth of knowledge and still is a dearth of knowledge about how many potential people with disabilities, players with disabilities are out there. Myself and Chris Power, the vice president of Able Gamers and my mentor in the leadership in the research realm, I should say, we decided to look and try to find out how many people with disabilities there are in the country that want to play games, how many players there are that identify as having disability. And looking at numbers from the ESA, we looked at numbers from the census. We looked at a number of sources and we finally were able to extrapolate the number of 48 million potential players with disabilities in the United States. And let me tell you, when we were able to walk up to a company and say, hey, do you know there's like potentially 46 million companies or customers in the country that you could be servicing if you made your game more accessible? All of a sudden, that light bulb goes off. You know, when we say that for adults in the United States, the CDC says that 1 in 5 adults have a disability, that all of a sudden you're like, wait, how many people have it? It changes the mindset. It changes how you approach things. Because now all of a sudden you're like, whoa, that's a whole market I can tap into. And, you know,
this is the same to tie it back to, you said how like the experience of being a person of color is not exactly analogous, and you weren't saying that it was to having a disability. There's a parallel here in the sense that, you know, things are changing in terms of representation in media, not because someone woke up one day and like, or got visited by three ghosts or whatever and learned that it was the right thing to do, but because they've realized that the people they weren't addressing have spending power. And so things change.
I wish more people would just wake up and see a ghost that would tell them that diversity. That'd be fantastic.
Sounds like a scalable solution to me, but until that starts happening, we have, you know, appealing to that more sort of, you know, pragmatic or dollars and cents you know, way of thinking is the way we move things forward.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think, you know, to tie it into the idea of the arena sort of changing, I think it was changing before the XAC came out, but I think the floodgates sort of opened and people started paying attention when that happened. You know, we saw Logitech come out with the Logitech gaming adaptive gaming kit, which creates, you know, affordable peripherals that can be used in tandem with the Xbox adaptive controller. We saw Sony come out with the back attachment for the PlayStation 4 controllers that, you know, adds two extra buttons to the back and back of the controller. Like we're seeing a number of studios you know, adapt official practices in the accessibility realm. I mean, as we saw actually today, Square Enix they released an article talking about Marvel's The Avengers, today being the time of recording, May 28th. So they talked about, you know, Crystal Dynamics and the approach that they've had to accessibility, you know, and we were lucky enough to be able to go to Crystal Dynamics, myself and Mark Barlet, and actually administer this 2-day course that our organization has developed called Accessible Player Experiences, to help these developers sort of understand what people with disabilities, what type of experiences they're looking to have in games. So this APX practitioner course, as we call it, APX being Accessible Player Experience, course is a 2-day course that allows developers to sort of get a better idea of some of the barriers that people with disabilities might be encountering in games. And we saw Crystal Dynamics kind of talking about that, and also they brought in Cherry Thompson, and you know, Cherry Thompson is a accessibility consultant in the space, that is incredibly vocal about the considerations and thought process that needs to go into games from an accessibility standpoint. And Crystal Dynamics brought them in and you know, had them scan motion capture Cherry in a wheelchair and the motions that Cherry has when they're using a wheelchair in order to accurately capture how someone in a wheelchair might move realistically. Mm. And what you're seeing there is the notion of bringing in someone who has a disability to improve that experience and to diversify the portrayal of it, of people with disabilities in their game. And that's remarkable. It's huge.
So we can use the incentives of straight up capitalism to move things forward. And again, a very pragmatic way. But we should never let that stop us from imagining a more radically improved world. On that note, here's Emma Kinema, previously of Game Workers Unite and currently of Code CWA.
Many of us tend to think that we live in democracies, but really, you know, if you spend 8 hours of work every day, you're spending the vast majority of your waking life in essentially an autocratic, authoritarian, top-down dictatorial structure, which yeah. is not to say, you know, people are, you know, locking you up in prison cells to make video games, but really, actually, like, think about how much better our games could be and the medium itself could be if workers were more empowered to really have a much broader say in the way our companies are made and the games that we work on get made. Because, I mean, ultimately, who knows better than us workers, the people who actually make the video games, to make the video games, right? Like, we should have our fair share in how this game industry is run and how our medium is run. And because we're the ones actually making the damn thing. And I frankly yeah. think we know best how to really innovate and make wonderful games and things. And I think the idea that every once in a while I hear this concern from people that like, oh, if we unionize, you know, the games industry, you know, creativity is going to get locked down and you can't make any decisions and it's going to really kind of stifle the industry. And really, I think it's the exact opposite, because what is more stifling than, you know, your shareholders deciding, actually, we need to lay off 800 people because I don't know, we want more money and our stock prices need to rise before Q3, right? Instead of investing in people and investing in long-term knowledge. And ultimately, if we keep treating people this way, the way we have been, you know, we have an average 5 to 7 year burnout rate in the games industry. And to me, that means how much just sheer wealth of knowledge and expertise and craft are we losing every 5 to 7 years as these more senior, more experienced workers eventually leave because, you know, they want to have kids and they want to plan for retirement and they want healthcare and they want to live in somewhere accessible. And, you know, people think, you know, these tough working conditions and this kind of dog eat dog culture makes really strong, tough game developers. But what it really means is actually most people leave, and it means we lose a lot of the craft. And no wonder the games industry kind of reinvents the wheel every like few years, you know, and we have trouble innovating. And I also think about places like Telltale, where in talking with so many of my friends who used to work there, really, a lot of them really believe, and I think it's pretty fair, that the company really kind of started to go under primarily because leadership wouldn't let the company innovate. They wouldn't let the workers innovate. because they were so obsessed with just reproducing the same success formula over and over and over. When workers wanted to push for new modes of design and storytelling and telling more unique IPs and all kinds of things. And I don't know if the workers had more of a say in how their company was run and what projects got greenlit and how we made our games. I think that company might still be around today. And, you know, I don't like engaging in speculation, but I mean, I don't know. This is me talking to whoever might be listening. Like, think about your workplace. How many good ideas get voiced and how many actually make it to the kind of end product? Like, and sometimes, like, I mean, I know personally, like, I've worked in like AAA cinematics and stuff where animators had really wonderful ideas for a certain scene and it just got boiled down to the most dull thing that you could possibly imagine because some higher up was like, oh, I don't know, this seems a little too out there, a little too whatever. And really, you just get kind of generic mush. And so, yeah, I think it's really important both for the quality of the games and for the quality of the careers and lives of people actually making the games that we organize. I think it's really essential.
And actually, before we leave the conversation with Emma behind, one more quick word from her.
If you like your job, if you like your company, hell, even if you like your boss, because I've been there, I've been at places where I really do actually like and respect my boss, believe it or not. Even if you do, even if you're pretty comfortable, and even if you've got it pretty well, you should still organize because you only have that good, stable situation on the whims of management. But if you organize, you can write it into stone, you can get into a contract, you can ensure that even if times get tough in the future, you and your coworkers have a voice and a guaranteed say in how the company manages itself and how it takes care of its workers and how it takes care of the quality of the product you make. And I think that's something really important to understand, you know, because I think so many people, especially in the games industry, have, especially some of our more senior colleagues, have seen conditions and quality slip in the last, you know, 10, 20 years. And like, there's a greater and greater reliance on kind of low wage, low condition kind of QA testers and contracting and outsourcing. And really what that really is a degradation of kind of the floor of quality in the industry and a floor of conditions in the industry. And if our companies can just keep undercutting certain sections of workers, even if today we're still fine in you know, as full-time employees, one day they're going to come for you too. And you'll wish we had all been organized by the time that happens. So I think to kind of put a cap on that, I think it's so important that both in these kind of more typical kind of studios that people are more familiar with, we organize, even if people feel like, you know, the floor is not falling out from under them yet. But most importantly, we also have to be organizing with the contractors and the freelancers and the outsourcing companies where people are hurting the most, because they're just as essential, even if we don't really get to see them in the public eye a lot more than, you know, some of the more typical game worker experiences at these major companies.
Because we do our best to talk to developers and other games-adjacent folks from all over the world, there is no universal set of conditions under which the games we talk about get made. So along those lines, here's Nils Denikin talking about how Mutazione's 12-year development cycle was really only possible because of the specific conditions of arts grants and so on in Denmark. One other thing I guess I do want to bring attention to, as long as we're talking about, you know, the fact that you're in Denmark, is that this game was partially funded by an arts grant. Is that correct?
Yeah. Not only once. We had a few art grants. Three from the Danish Film Institute have been like, they have different steps of art grants. So we already, like, in 2009, we got the first one for like a prototype grant, a small one, to test the idea and to make a prototype. And then we at some point we had a demo grant, and we had and the end we had like a grant from them that helps us release the game. There was another grant from like the Nordic Game, which that organization doesn't, the Nordic Game Program, which doesn't exist anymore. So like it went through a lot of phases. We also had a grant from Creative Europe. So we used all the grant possibilities that are possible here for that game. It also, because it was such a learning process, and, you know, making a narrative game where you want to show off the world and the story, you need to have a certain production value before you go to, you know, the big publishers and show off the game. Because, yeah, it takes some resources to kind of get to that state. And on top of that, it was a big learning process, right? Like those, like 2008, I was just fresh off university. I had really no experience of, you know, like game design. You know, that was everything I learned along the way through, you know, meeting people and meeting the right people and, you know, reading myself into that and getting into the whole indie scene, right? So like there were so many mistakes along the way, and the process was so organic of that game growing and changing. That's, you know, it was like a very improbable project in the end. Like it was really improbable that we could get funding when you look at it from the beginning, or we were able to kind of release it at some point in a state that we were, you know, proud of, or like that, you know, it was very close to the intention in the end, right? But in between, we were really like, before we got, you know, the funding from Sony, it was like, we were, you know, almost like if we hadn't gotten that, it definitely would have never made it. That was kind of the last chance when we kind of pitched the game, because we already had spent too much time on it, and then, you know, most of us didn't really believe in it anymore, and it was like, okay, let's just try this one last time. And yeah, and then they really liked what they saw, and then it was like, okay, well, I guess we'll, you know, continue this. And
when, yeah, you say most of you didn't believe in it anymore, do you mean you didn't believe that it was sort of commercially possible to complete it, or do you mean that like some of the team was, you know, falling out of love with the world in a certain sense?
Well, we had also very shifting teams at that point, because we had those we were able to hire people for this grant money, right? But we didn't have any continuous funding, so we had actually a bit of a fluctuation in the team. And then, like, remember Douglas had moved to New York, and we were all kind of spread out, actually. So, and but then we were like, okay, I was just, you know, like making this trailer to pitch the game, and Christopher, who was our biz dev guy, and he, you know, he had produced a game previously, where we, you know, it's just as a day job thing. He was like, okay, yeah, let's try this. And, you know, I would be the producer. And we, you know, like we tried to pitch it, you know, ask people for contacts to pitch the game and set up meetings. And, you know, that was kind of, that was that, right? That was our kind of last straw for getting the game realized. And, you know, then it happened, and then we kind of assembled a team after that and got people excited again. And yeah, but it was a pretty improbable problem. It was like this really naive student dream, like coming out of university and like, hey, I want to make games. And I want to, you know, make this game world, and I want this to exist, right? And then figuring out along the way how this is, you know, possible. Which is, you know, like very, like very naive, but that, you know, that naivety kind of made it possible, right? Otherwise, you know, that game wouldn't exist.
If you'd worried about what was viable or even what was possible, then you wouldn't have started this project. And then this
no. And everyone was advising against this. Like when you heard a lot of talks, then was at the Independent Games Summit, and all the veterans, they were like, okay, this is when you pitch a game. Don't do this. Don't get too emotionally invested. don't make this your baby, you know, keep that distance, be, you know, like prepare to just throw it away if it doesn't work immediately and stuff like that, right? And I was like, you know, I guess, you know, typical thing, like you're like, no, I, you know, this is going to be great and I can do this. And you know, then 12 years later, that's like the consequence of that, right?
Something else we tried to get better at talking about this past year is game feel. Talking about how you make a game feel the way it feels when you play it in a way that is both technically accurate and accessible to a broad audience. So here's Mu Yu talking about the specific game feel challenges of Knights and Bikes.
I learned a lot of that kind of stuff about game feel working at Insomniac on the Ratchet and Clank series. And it was very much like, you know, huge particle effects and like timing, certain timing elements and certain like, you know, breaks in timing and that kind of thing. And it was just so weird, like applying those same things to such silly abilities. I mean, the one I spent the most time on was the sink plunger, just trying to figure out like, how do you make like a useful mechanic out of it, but that's also just sort of absurd. And you're trying to get a different game feel out of it, right? You don't want to feel insanely powerful. You want to feel really playful. And so it's just trying to, you know, work with those kinds of constraints and think about how do you capture this idea of whimsy and silliness and with the same kinds of techniques that, you know, I learned trying to make ratchet weapons or ratchet whatever feel really strong and powerful.
Yeah, completely. I think the game, and the, you know, this comes through really, really clearly on a story level, but it also comes through maybe more subtly, but no less importantly, on a mechanical level. It's like, what is really happening? I'm wiggling my fingers in this game is like so up for grabs, it's almost not that interesting a question, because it's very much from a kid, or more accurately, two kids' points of view.
Yeah. I mean, one of the funny things is like, I had like a very close friend, game designer, and like I would always bounce ideas off of him when I was trying to work through the mechanics of stuff. And every time he's just like, but is it real or is it not? Because if it's real, it has to be like this. And if it's not real, I'm like, you have to get familiar with the idea that like it's somewhere in between. Like it's, you know, it's that sort of unreliable narrator situation. It's the story that's being told by a child. And he's like, but did it happen? Are these things really in the room? And I'm just like, this is not the right way to think about it. And it was just so funny just coming, trying to like, you know, convey this idea to someone for whom it was just so foreign. But yeah, just playing with that idea. And I think we lose that. Like, I think as an adult, it is very important as an adult to know what is true and what is not. I mean, you know, living in this time.
absolutely, yeah.
Feels more important than ever. But I think as a child, like being able to blend between those two worlds, like whether it's like the real and the perceived or the subjective and the objective, I think these are like things that children sort of just blend really naturally between. And it's everything is sort of like seen through their eyes and seen like what it meant to them at the time. And I think that's a really important message. And I think it's a really important perspective that you can't forget that everyone, you know, adult or child, is still experiencing things from their own perspective and seeing things that way. And I think that's always going to inform how they react to things and what they see, what they actually see, you know, regardless of what the objective truth is.
Yeah, totally. And I think being in that space and remembering what it felt like as a child is really important, because you're 100% right that especially in the moment we're in, knowing what's real and what's not is vital. But part of getting your head around that is to not honor your existing assumptions too much, to remember that those categories are a little permeable, you know, like that, like national borders are less real than gravity, but more real than dragons. You know what I mean? There are these sort of like middle spaces that you have to be able to negotiate. Otherwise you get into the silly, you know, the silly conversations where it's like, well, you said race was a social construct. Why are we talking about race? Well, cause like something can be constructed, but real, right?
Yeah.
The idea of dealing with like that somewhat more, the much more permeable sense of what's real and what's not that a kid experiences sort of in a way that thinking about remembering what it was like to be a kid more generally can, it can open you up to like new experiences and new ways of seeing the world. And it can be, it's not just about whimsy or escapism, it's about like richness and beauty.
Yeah, and I think it's also like that reminder that like taking the time to view things from someone else's perspective. I think we as rational adults assume everyone else is a rational adult. And a lot of times it's like bewildering to think like, well, why would they think that if they're rational, like I'm rational, this is absurd. Where I think it's easier to to play that card on a child, or put yourself in the position of a child of just like, well, they don't understand everything. You know, you can think into their perspective and, you know, you can sort of understand why they see the world the way they do. And then once you sort of get into the practice of that, you realize we're not rational. None of us are rational adults. Like, we should be taking a lot more time thinking about the perspectives and of others and how they're seeing the world and how that informs the decisions they're making.
On a similar note of exploring key themes with and embedding a worldview within the core gameplay of a game, let's hear from Sean Alexander Allen about how fights and violence actually operate specifically in his rather incredible game, Treachery in Beatdown City.
Yeah, our game really started looking into trying to just make, like people that I would maybe want to fight, like a lot of times, or... just sure. It definitely I mean, a lot of the where it came from actually dealt with the fact of my constant anxiety living in the city, and you know, people yell at you and this and that, except again, I also specifically avoided I might take personality traits from somebody, like Ugly John as a character that I actually I saw a person who looked sort of like what I wanted to do. What I ended up turning into a design, I would sketch people sometimes after I saw them on the street, and then maybe take them in a completely different Ren and Stimpy direction. And but then there's also the homeless guy who I remember when I was trying to go walk to a self-employment assistance program class when I was on unemployment and just trying to earn some money while starting my LLC that would help me stay alive while making this game, would allow me to actually get some money for it early on. I got yelled at by a homeless guy twice, once on my way out, once on my way back in, where he was just yelling at me about asking for money. And then when I didn't give anything, he was upset. And then when I came back, he was like, "Oh, there you are again. You think you're better than me? You're not." And I'm just I want to say something so bad, but I'm I just keep walking, and you know, I mean, that's been my whole thing, is just keep walking. That's just who I am. So I don't get into fights. So it's even if someone aggresses at me on the street, I keep moving, because you know, the worst, I don't want to I feel like, you know, if you get into a fight, you might get into a fight. Just although one of my friends who got harassed recently, a guy I know got killed, because there was a thing recently, in the last few months, this guy, Jose Zambrano, was being harassed outside a bar, and I think he said something, I don't know, but it was by a bunch of dudes, and a dude knocked him down, and he hit his head on the corner really hard and died a couple of days later. So that was you know, that's it's wild, the streets are crazy, because it's even something you know, just a terrible shove could end your life. So yeah, it's I try to literally eyes down, keep walking as fast as possible. And I'm a tall dude, so people pick on me for that reason sometimes. You know, it's just
they have something to prove or whatever.
Yeah, although these days, fully bearded out, people don't really mess with me that often anymore.
The beard is what does it. That's interesting.
I don't know. It's just a lot of stuff. I probably just look tired and upset all the time, just because I don't know. Well, before all this pandemic stuff, I was basically just you know, just working on a game, trying to get it out, have a kid, have a day job. I'm please don't mess with me, because I just don't have it in me for anything.
Yeah. But, yeah. What it's like, the power, so any game with a lot of fighting is going to be a power fantasy to some degree, unless it's a game about being disempowered and getting the shit beat out of you, which those exist, mm-hmm. but they're few and far between. Right. But I think the power fantasy in Treachery and Beatdown City is closer to the fantasy in large parts of the Yakuza series or something, where it isn't like you're saying, these are people you want to fight, but the fantasy isn't really, or at least not exclusively, these are people I wish I could hurt and I don't get to hurt them in the real world, so I'm going to hurt them in a game. It's more about a power fantasy in which you get to resolve these situations instead of having to avoid them all the time and just keep walking, and where something as cathartic and straightforward as fighting is productive and maybe even in some contexts the good and loving thing to do, right? Those situations are, I think, at least in my experience, really, really few and far between in real life. But there is something, it's a more layered power fantasy than simply I am the strongest guy and I'm going to punch everybody. Like there's more going on there, I think, in a game like yours.
Yeah, that was the goal, definitely. Yeah, because all our people have their own, stories, which are, you know, still slowly like kind of unraveling. Like you were trying to make you learn more about people and their own anxieties, and their own, like Bruce is like, is a kind of like a, he overcompensates for something, right? You will learn about that over time, and like Lisa has her own like, just like anxieties, and Brad, they all have their own stuff. They only have their own like baggage, so it's just like
yeah.
Like, and they're like, you know what, like you know, they're like the, that's actually like a large part of the story is we actually changed the dialogue, because a lot of times before, some of the dialogue would be like, and the cutscene might even still be with the same characters, but we just change it so the enemies always talk first.
Mm.
So that there's a sort of something, either they're wasting your time by talking about nonsense on the street, and then they get upset because you want to dare interrupt them to tell them to get out of the way, or it's just they say something directly to you, as opposed to you being the aggressor, because the idea is that you're trying to get to City Hall. That's literally all you're trying to do. So like, and then that just changes it, where it's like you don't actively engage anyone. They actively engage you, or they actively block you. And that's like kind of the idea. That was always the idea. And then I didn't realize that, like, by having like one cutscene, Brad's just like, he used to be like, it's you again. And the person's like, whoa, man, I don't want any trouble. And in this one, they're like, it's you again. And then Brad's like, I don't want any trouble. Right. And so, like, you know, it just changes, because it's like the whole thing is it's like Brad knows he's a strong dude who can, like, flaming uppercut somebody. Like, he knows this, he doesn't need anybody to like justify that he's a big strong dude. Like, he just is tired, he's an old guy, an older guy who just wants to see what the hell's going on at City Hall.
When to the degree that he starts shit, it's only because it's like he has a stake in it for his community, right? It's like he wants to like literally beat some sense into somebody.
Well, he doesn't start fights because of that. He interjects in a conversation that happened before.
Totally important distinction.
And then the thing is, the people get upset that he's trying to offer help.
Right.
And that
totally.
You know, it's what happens. It's like people like get upset at you. I mean, and granted, you know, like, you know, unwanted help is, it's like a whole thing, but I mean, like, unwanted help, even in like friendships in your life, like, you might see that person get really upset with you if you tell them something that's against their worldview.
Another game that I thought did an incredible job of exploring big, heady themes through intimate personal relationships was NeoCab. So here's Paula Rogers and Vincent Perea talking about how the core relationship in that game reflects the overall works view of our relationship to technology. How we should maybe question it a little, maybe, I think.
Once we had that A story in place between Lena and Savvy, it was about going back to the themes that were established very early on, where it's like, okay, we want to comment on the gig economy, we want to talk about what does autonomous labor do to our economy, what does it do to the value of human work. Nothing good, you know. how can we integrate that? How can we mirror those like intellectual, abstract themes in something relatable and story-driven and character-based? And so it was really fleshing out the character of Savvy to kind of embody the kind of devil's bargain that we all make with technology. And of course, like, Savvy is a very compelling, attractive, charismatic person who seems like she can open up all these cool doors for you, and isn't that what tech is too? And then you realize, oh, I'm in really deep, and maybe she doesn't have my best interests at heart, but now we know we're so close, our lives are intertwined. How do I step back from that? So that was like a big, one of my favorite things was working on that, on like, how can we get the characters and the story to align with a lot of the thematic things that were in place when I joined, that Patrick and Duncan and Robin and Vincent had worked on.
That didn't occur to me quite in those words as I was playing, but it was, of course, like in the corner of my eye, so to speak, that the game sort of it draws a parallel between that moment, or that much more than a moment, that long period of time where you're reconsidering the contours of how you relate to a person, compares that with maybe us as a culture falling out of love with the techno utopia we were promised, or realizing it isn't what we were promised. Yes, in fact,
yeah.
Or that it makes the whole thing feel of a piece on a thematic level for sure.
Good.
Oh man,
yeah. Working as intended.
I'm so rude.
You should have hung up. That would have been amazing. Boom. Did the mic drop? And just boom, done.
Yeah, right.
Oh, man. So funny.
It's weird. She deleted her account.
I know. Where is she?
She disappeared from the face of the earth. she just fluttered away, faded away. It made me think when you're talking about that, Paula, about an interesting tidbit about Savvy and like her visual design, because it was interesting is that like as they were sort of crafting the story and like kind of in the writing sense, I kind of like, you know, searching for Savvy, I kind of felt that way on the art side. Like I felt like I always had in the back of my mind, like, okay, I can't do Savvy. I can't design her right now. Like I'm very much like, I get a little weird about doing a character at the right time when I have the option. And this wasn't like a sort of a AAA style production where, you know, it's Monday and the sprint is beginning and I have to work on Savvy. And then I have to have 5 different designs by the end of the week. It was more of like, hey, I get to decide when and I work on these characters. But at a certain point, it reached this like critical mass where like we couldn't cut trailers for the game if Savvy didn't exist. And so I'd been kind of pushing it off for a while because I just felt this like overwhelming burden of like making sure this character lived up to like the story and lived up to this like pursuit and meant so much to Lena. But what's funny about it is right at the, you know, within the first few months of the project, I had I'd done a concept of a character, and then I ended up using that look to build the very first prototype of the very first actually good prototype of our character rigs. And then I refined their look more to figure out how the rest of the style of the game would look and how the other character's quality could come up. And so I had this really cool looking character with this, you know, fashionable future. She was just like some cool looking future girl. And I was like, oh, this is like my template for a character. This is like my bar for characters in our game. And then I remember I was thinking like, okay, I have these like specific ideas for Savvy. And then Paula and Patrick came to me with the pitch of like, hey, that first person you designed, what if she was Savvy? And I was like, oh yeah, I guess she is. And it was this really beautiful rant like thing to me that like I felt like I'd been searching everywhere for this character, and it was like, oh, it was so obvious when they said it that like it took us a couple of like weeks to really like just say it, like say that was it. Mm-hmm. But the minute they said it, I knew it to be true. I was like, this is Savvy. And like, I remember thinking like, how am I going to convince them this should be Savvy? Even though it was both their ideas. Like I was gearing myself up to argue with them of like, you know, cause I like, oh no, how am I going to pitch this as Savvy? That is such a great, it made me mad. It was such a great idea. I just partly cause what it meant for me and like her look and everything. And like, it was just so perfect. And so then I ended up refining her one more time. And then that was the character. And it was like amazing. Cause like as a visual designer, I love things like that. I love when like, you know, I of course love like, you know, having a plan, executing that plan, and then boom, this is the final character. But I actually really like adding randomness kind of in my process a little bit, where like, I didn't know that was going to be Savvy, but it worked out that way. Like, it's like, of course that's Savvy, you know, it's like, I don't know. It feels like, you know, it's having a hard way of describing it, but
no, it's like you have to give yourself permission to be surprised or space to be surprised.
Yeah.
It just feels more like a natural creation to me than like, oh, I forced this thing to exist. It's like, oh, this thing happened. And I always trust things like that, like decisions that come quicker or happened through happenstance, I'm always pleased with, because it's like I'm not fully in control of the creative process in a way.
If we're going to talk about using chance or accidents or a little bit of chaos in the game design process, we have to talk a little bit about Aruvite Akari and how Baba became Baba in Baba Is You. I know that in the original Jam version, you were sort of thinking of Baba as a robot. Or thinking of the player character thing as a robot, and sort of moved to this nondescript, you know, fuzzy round creature later on, based on a piece of art someone else drew, where like what you thought were little sort of robot antennae got interpreted as ears. Is that right? So like you,
yeah, or horns, like it was a goat.
It was a person. Goat creature, exactly. Yeah. And then they sort of became ears, right? I mean, I think when I look at Baba, I picture them as sort of rabbitish ears, but that's exactly it. It's open to interpretation, right? The game has this sort of sketchy style where things are recognizable. I mean, at least you know a rock is a rock, you know a wall is a wall, but it leaves a ton to the imagination, which I think gels really well with this idea that reality is up for grabs, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of, I think I had some plans of, the game has this wobbly animation style, and I'm pretty sure that I explicitly thought of, at some point, that if the game looks slightly like a drawing, it kind of emphasizes the fact that none of the objects, not even Baba, are anything on their own. And I really, really wanted to, in some ways, bring home the idea that like Baba, the creature you see in the game, is not really anything, but rather like when you say Baba Is You, then you give Baba the kind of consciousness, you give Baba the you-ness it has. And yeah. Otherwise, Baba is the same as a rock, they just look different.
No, I mean, totally. I mean, that's an aspect of the game that I think the people who come at it because they're interested in sort of programming-ish challenges don't necessarily, are not necessarily as into, right? The folks you were talking about who are more interested in the strangeness of it and the cause and effect and the almost sandboxy nature of just seeing what you can change, I think maybe generally tend to be the ones who think of it more as a giant metaphor for consciousness and how, you know, what consciousness is separate from what we think of as just being alive even, and the transferability of it. And the game can get you thinking some weird ass thoughts.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting that when I made the game jam version, some people, like one of the things that encouraged me to consider making a full game was people telling me that the game kind of made them think of that kind of like consciousness and that kind of stuff. And it was really intriguing to me because I hadn't considered that at all when I started making the game or making the game jam version. But I don't think I have really heard after release that much pondering on that. Like I've personally kind of made Baba to be more of a character of its own. Like it's been a lot of fun to kind of draw fan art of my own game and post it on the official Twitter where Baba is doing things as a kind of a this distinct character, but I guess the game is still abstract enough that most people might approach it more either on the level that, okay, it's an abstract game, it's a puzzle game, the idea is not to really ponder on the themes it has, but more on the kind of gameplay and the design, or they might be concentrating on like, here there's a cute creature called Baba, I wonder what kind of a creature Baba is, and then they like
sure
get enjoyment about considering the character.
I may be unusual and a weirdo, and maybe that's why I do a podcast about video games, but like for me the statement Baba Is You was immediately interesting on a bunch of levels, because, you know, as you've said, Baba is intentionally a little bit nondescript, you know, like what is Baba, and then for that matter, you know, what is you? You know what I mean? It's kind of a deep question that's always a little bit at play in video games. Are you supposed to be your avatar? Are you in some way omnisciently controlling your avatar? Is who you are up for grabs? And then honestly, even like the game invites you to ask what is like, what does that is, you know, a word actually do in terms of the relation between the two letters? So I don't know. Maybe it's I don't know. It feels like you were thoughtful about what this game does with language and how, you know, it's supposed to make you think, it feels like to me, a little bit about those relationships between things. But there's enough of a meal to make of just the puzzle design, just the pushing, just the rule stuff, that you could very happily ignore all that.
Yeah, it's at least I did write down the like lore of the world of Baba Is You, like why. There's an intro cutscene, there are ending cutscenes, so if you really look into it, it might not be like in the game enough that you can like figure out what is going on, but at least I personally know what the kind of story is and why things are happening in the game. And I'm kind of, even if the game doesn't really kind of emphasize or capitalize on the kind of lore or story themes enough, I'm happy that I did the work of figuring them out for myself, because it can be helpful later, or it can be just funny for myself.
So whether or not Arvi would use these words, we were sort of talking about narrative design there. As such, let's close out by talking to a narrative designer, specifically Damon Rees, talking about their work on Necrobarista. So you are a narrative designer by trade. On this game, on Necrobarista, you're credited as the lead writer, which this is not in any way to diminish the role of lead writer, which is a very important and very august role, but that is at least potentially narrower than what I would think of, and I think what you would think of, as what a narrative designer does. So
absolutely,
Was your role on this more just as the lead writer, or did you have a hand in, you know, UI and fonts and, you know, like things that are that people don't think of as storytelling, but absolutely influence how the story is told?
Yeah, so hilariously, you know, I spend my entire career grinding my narrative design skills, and my big breakout hit is a completely linear visual novel.
Sure, the least Metroid Prime thing you've ever worked on.
Yeah, but I was involved in some stuff, like a little bit of help with the storyboarding, for example. My script was very, very visual, so I was leaving notes for the storyboarders and stuff like facial expressions, which is stuff that I didn't work directly on, ideas for like sound cues, etc. So it was probably quite similar process to writing just a screenplay, which again, you know, ironic.
Yeah, highly. Yeah, because it is a story that is very I don't know that it would work as well as a film, right? There are some games where you can somewhat tell that there are frustrated filmmakers working on it, and they can nonetheless be good games, yeah. Right? But that's like built into the DNA. I don't think Necrobarista is like that. I think it is a game, you know, from the first, even when it is just a series of sort of linear, you know, dialogue sections and images and such.
Absolutely, yeah, and writing for the form is so important, and it's been really gratifying to see this like actually mentioned in some reviews and stuff. I definitely approached it like a stage play in regards to the characters, like a very small cast of characters, with this in, you know, complex web of relationships between them, and just throwing them into a stressful situation and watching them bounce off each other.
Absolutely. Did you start with characters? Did you start with like scenario and plot? You said you joined the project after some decisions were already made, so did you already have a setting to deal with, some basic bullet points, like what did you walk in on, and then where did you begin, you know, sort of like crafting the thing that we see now?
Yeah, so we had the had the setting, had the character designs, had character concepts, and had a very particular feel that Kevin, the director, wanted me to convey. Specifically, what he wanted was, and he wouldn't stop talking about this, was the idea of, or the feeling of being at a friend's house for a sleepover and staying up late playing video games. Hmm. And that feeling when you know the sun's about to come up and you're going to have to go home soon, but you don't want to, and you just want to drag that moment out forever. And so I think we captured that, and probably quite a bit more.
No, that's great. It does capture that moment. I mean, like that, because that's like a primal memory of not wanting something to end. And of course, you know, like the, you know, staring death down is a much more high stakes version of that, right? But yeah, no, to find the confluence there makes a lot of sense. I'm very interested in the idea of approaching it like a play, because it is almost, there are some shots where you see the whole coffee shop, and you can almost imagine it as like a single set play, or like the sort of play where there's one big set that turns around when we're supposed to be downstairs or something like that. Like it is staged in this kind of very, you know, staged way. That's a silly sentence, but you know what I mean, right? It is a cast of characters.
Yeah.
It's structured like a modern play, in the sense that we have this core cast, but then there are, you know, single scene or two scene characters who just sort of pop up for, you know, like important thematic reasons.
Yeah, and they're coming back later. Like we've got DLCs coming out with them, free DLCs, nice, for those characters.
I was going to say, because like that makes it feel more like a play when Samantha shows up, for example. But it also seems to violate the other thing that is very interesting about the game. And violate is probably too strong a word, but it goes against the grain of what's so impressive about it, which is that it feels as lush as it feels, because I get the sense the team was ludicrously disciplined in terms of scope, in terms of only, you know, making what you planned to use a lot.
Absolutely. And that's a really important part of I think any competent game writer's approach, being very aware of what you're able to do and doing as much as you possibly can with that, without making your artists or your programmers or your producers cry.
right. And that's the show. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger-Michaels, with all manner of support this week, including clip selection from Francis Michelle Cannon and Lucio Valentino. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from the Noun Project. You can find us everywhere podcasts are a thing, and if you want to support the show and are able to do so, you can do so at patreon.com/ETAO. Thanks tremendously to our current patrons, with a very special thanks to the mysterious Ian K, Lucas Cosin, and Darth Raptora. You can also, if you feel like it, buy something on our Nexus storefront at nexus.gg/ETAO. As previously mentioned, Patreonizers will not be charged for this week's episode. This is a bonus, which means we will see you not in 2 weeks, but in 1 week. See you then. Hope your 2021 is good so far, everybody.